All right, well, the dominant images that we really associate with Sri Lanka and have been portrayed in recent times have been ones of bloody civil war between the oppressed Tamil community and the majority Sinhalese government. Recent images assaulting our television screens and papers are of heated battles, of state-inflicted terror, of civilians denied hospital treatment, of children aching for their dead relatives, of blood, of desperation and division. And actually, from a cursory glance, all of that division and all of that hostility is actually almost the only narrative in Sri Lankan history. But I want to argue today that that kind of perspective is narrow at best and distorting at worst. So this talk is not actually going to offer an explanation of the conflict, but rather I want to give some sense of the history before this conflict became the overriding feature of Sri Lankan society. And I want to tell the story of the Sri Lankan Trotskyists, partly because it is a very inspiring story for the left today, but also because, in a way, it suggests that a lot of the communal conflicts, which are taken as inevitable, actually suggests that they have not always been dominant and are therefore not set in stone. So today I want to actually delve into the history of working class politics in Sri Lanka, or Ceylon as it was known, and offer a history of the Ceylonese Trotskyists, or the Lanka Sama Samaja Party, or the LSSP. So the LSSP was actually a very significant force in working class politics in Ceylon for at least 30 years, and at various different points in time it was larger and more dominant amongst the working class and amongst the mass of the Ceylonese population than both the Stalinist Communist Party and the Social Democratic Parties, or the equivalents of the Labour Party. And just to give you some sense of the kind of standing of this organisation, up until, you know, reasonably recently, the word socialist in Sinhalese is actually Sama Samaja, and that was coined after the party. So it was actually the name entered the language via the name of the party. So it really gives you a sense of the standing and depth of weight of the party. So the story of the LSSP actually begins in the 1930s, when Sri Lanka was still a very valuable British colony. Ceylon was colonised by the British in the 1830s, and as in so many parts of the world, we in Australia obviously understand, the British wreaked absolute devastation wherever they went. They destroyed the local economy in Sri Lanka by establishing large-scale plantations across the country, and these plantations were basically worked by both local labour but also by imported Tamil labour from the south of India, which was sort of forcibly brought down from there. And really, the conditions in these plantations were absolutely appalling. Plantation workers were treated like animals, and in 1935, one report suggested that the life expectancy of workers who worked on these plantations was only 27. So that'd mean most people, hopefully most people in this room, would be dead or alive, actually. We're making any aspersions on how old people are here. So, but despite those kind of appalling conditions, large-scale labour rebellions, both on the plantations and in the developing cities, didn't actually start to flare up until the 1920s. But when they flared, they really, really flared. Militant working class struggle burst onto the stage in the 1920s with a series of strikes. 1923 saw a general strike in Colombo, which is the main city, of 20,000 workers. And the following year saw major and significant and often quite violent and disruptive strikes of the harbour workers, the taxi drivers, tramway workers, and all of these people, you know, were engaged in long sort of battles of attrition between them and the local capitalists. This period also saw the emergence of a local capitalist class, or a Ceylonese bourgeoisie. And this particular class, their wealth was derived from coconut, from rubber, timber, cinnamon, graphite, as well as from renting and urban property. And this local bourgeoisie actually became quite frustrated with the lack of political and democratic rights associated with British colonialism in Sri Lanka. And so a fair amount of sort of nationalist agitation, began around organisations made up of these people. And so it was into this whole political and industrial situation that the LSSP emerged. But the original leadership of the LSSP didn't actually spring fully formed from the Ceylonese labour movement, but rather they developed out of and were influenced by the international communist movement in Britain in particular. With the economic boom in the early 1920s, many of the newly prosperous sort of rural middle classes sent their children to Britain to be educated. And because they weren't able to afford the sort of toffiest institutions like Oxford or Cambridge, which I know at least one of our members has been to, they overwhelmingly... Thank you, Tom. They overwhelmingly, on the other hand, sent their children to the University of London, which in my opinion is no bad thing. And it was actually here that the Ceylon Students Association was actually formed. And that association became a very important centre for discussion, for debate, for clarifying ideas amongst a lot of the migrant students. They began to be influenced by the broader political climate in Britain, which was, you know, developing rapidly to the left. They were also influenced by some of the Indian radical nationalist groups, which were in London, had a fair bit of influence at the time. And they, out of all of this, they began to develop something of a socialist core. And the figures in this socialist core would actually later go on to be some of the dominant personalities of the LSSP. So people like Philip Gruner-Wardina, Leslie Gruner-Wardina, spelt slightly differently, Colvin R. De Silva, N. M. Pereira, and Dr. S. A. Wickramasinghe. And several of these people actually acquired a knowledge of Marxism through contact with British Marxist intellectuals, as well as some practical experience in some of the local communist parties and local other sort of communist organisations. And Trotsky's left opposition views within the communist movement influenced a number of them, but one in particular, Philip Gruner-Wardina, who on his way back from London to Ceylon actually went via Europe and visited and stayed with a number of the sort of major representatives of the left opposition in Europe. While in Britain, the socialist core actually began to decide that on their return to Ceylon, they needed to establish a party, they needed to establish some kind of clear grouping which could stand against the capitulations and the timid and co-opted local labour movement, as well as to try and develop some alternative current against the sort of wealthy nationalists who were beginning to agitate. But this new organisation wasn't actually established until the 18th of December 1935, despite the fact that the majority of the students had been returning over a previous 5-year period. Initially, the LSSP was not an explicitly Trotskyist organisation. It rather saw itself as a broad-based radical party which could include radical nationalists and socialists, and which, in their words, could give a socialist direction to the struggle for political freedom and for democratic rights. So the party was launched to great success, and from its very beginning, it found support amongst some of the radicalising urban youth, amongst some of the plantation workers, and also amongst sections of the working class. The party held its first regular national conference in December in 1936, and its second one a year later, and it began to issue several different publications around this time. Its official paper in Sinhalese was started in July 1936, and to give you a sense of the sort of, you know, massive explosion of growth, at its first, you know, the first paper that they put out only printed 2,000, but it actually grew to 20,000 by the next year, May of the next year, and there was similar sort of explosion and a spectacular explosion in membership. And at its inception, there were only 80 members, and in 1937, there were 800 members. So, you know, it gives some sense of, you know, how rapidly things were changing. But there was still a debate about whether or not, you know, were all these people committed to Marxist politics? You know, were they just joining because this seemed like the thing to do? You know, what was the nature of the party? And so in this time, there are all debates going on amongst the leadership about, you know, what was the nature of the group and how it would begin to develop. And within all of those debates, there was a sort of core of Trotskyists who had developed from Britain, who were beginning to argue for a much more explicitly revolutionary perspective, and arguing that even if it meant they lost some members, they needed to develop a more sort of rigorous Marxist training process. So, by the beginning of the Second World War, this sort of Trotskyist core had actually managed to win the majority of the party leadership to their position, and they proceeded to break with the Stalinists. Despite being forced underground in the Second World War and with the majority of its leadership either overseas or in prison, the LSSP managed to survive the Second World War and emerged in the late 40s and 50s, leading a number of significant upsurges in anti-colonial and working class struggle. The party remained sizeable into the 60s, but actually, unfortunately, a series of sort of opportunist turns and an increasing orientation to the parliamentary arena led them down a dubious non-revolutionary path where, unfortunately, they ended up in government with one of the Sinhalese sort of chauvinist parties. But the point of this talk is not to give an account of the Summer Samaja's decline, but rather to give some sense of their heyday. So to that end, I just wanted to sort of offer a few stories, a few tasty vignettes, hopefully a few themes which highlight some of the key political questions which faced the LSSP in their early years and actually how they managed to gain a mass following through some of these issues that arose. So one of the overarching political questions for any socialist in Ceylon from the 30s onwards was really how to relate to the question of British colonialism and the anti-colonial movement. I think it's important to note here, before we sort of get into the story, that the LSSP actually managed to develop and grow out of the colonial movement, not because they maintained a more cautious or a more conservative approach, but rather because their radicalism, their sort of radical attitude, actually enabled them to both lead a radicalising movement and to actually steer it in a useful direction. So amongst the radical youth who had stayed and studied in Ceylon during the 1920s, there was a great dissatisfaction with the existing political parties. And these radicalising youth began to coalesce into the youth leagues in the early 1930s. And they were influenced by a whole variety of different political currents, radical Indian nationalism being one of them, and often these young radicals railed against both political domination and economic domination. But while shifting leftward, these young radicals had not yet reached socialist conclusions. But in 1932, much of this changed. Many of the communist students returned from Britain and were faced with a decision about how to relate to this sort of newly radicalising movement. And after some debate, these young communists joined the youth leagues themselves, judging that they didn't actually have the forces to sort of coalesce their own party just yet. So they joined the youth leagues, they engaged in a series of debates with the young nationalists, in particular around the question of the working class, the relationship between the anti-colonial struggle and the socialist one, and what attitude to take to the bourgeois nationalist forces. And while there isn't heaps of detail about the ways in which these debates were actually conducted and how they won them, it's pretty clear that by the early 1930s, more and more of the arguments that the communists were making began to gel with a section of the youth. And one indication of this is that more and more of the articles in the Youth League journals, actually reflecting some of this shift. So in September of 1932, Colvin de Silva wrote an article in the Young Ceylon, which basically proclaimed that communism was the new thing, it was the new black, which, you know, everyone sort of had to, get on with. And in the same edition, Robin Rutnam forecast that the youth of Ceylon had a great opportunity to create a new social order. And now I just want to talk briefly about one of the most significant campaigns that emerged out of all of this in the early 1930s. And this was the Surya Mal movement. And this movement began with a dynamic which would probably be familiar to anyone who knows anything about colonial history at all. Having fought for the British in World War I, many Ceylonese soldiers, most of whom were actually conscripted, on their return home, and even for American soldiers today, you can see too, on their return home from fighting in this long, protracted war, found themselves utterly abandoned by the British Army. They didn't get any healthcare, they got, very little pension rights, many of them utterly ruined by the war, felt understandably bitter. And this situation actually prompted these returned servicemen to campaign for more rights. And this movement found its sort of symbolic expression each year in the Anti-Poppy Day campaign. And so poppies were sold in Ceylon, as in Australia, every year on the 11th of November, which is Remembrance Day. in order to actually raise money for returned soldiers. But the most galling thing about this whole story in Ceylon is that not one single cent of the money raised by the Poppy campaign went to one Ceylonese soldier. It all went straight back home to the British soldiers. And so this situation, you know, which is absolutely galling, you know, racist and appalling, rightly began, you know, to shift some of the returned servicemen into action and into activity. And in response, they started up sort of rival flower sales. It all sounds a little, you know, unrevolutionary, but, you know, flower selling on the corner. They actually decided that they would sell the Surya Mal, which is a sort of small white local Ceylonese flower, in opposition to the Poppy Day sales. And this actually caused quite a bit of a stir. In Colombo, there are a number of sort of poppy Surya Mal riots, you know, the different groups trying to sell the different sorts of flowers. And actually in most schools and workplaces, the selling of the Surya Mal, or even if you wore the Surya Mal, you know, it was basically banned in most public services. So this campaign began as that sort of symbolic day, but it actually gained speed and found a newfound radicalism under a new socialist leadership of the youth leagues. And the campaign for the selling of these flowers actually began to take on an explicitly anti-British character. And in 1933, the campaign even developed a socialist slant. So, you know, while people were selling the flowers, they were also leafleting and, you know, they were selling the magazines that they sort of produced around the question. And in one article in particular, Terence de Silva ended, you know, his piece with an appeal to the movement to unite in this battle to establish a socialist democratic Ceylon. So one small step from, you know, a small white flower to a socialist democratic Ceylon. This is the sort of path they were trying to take. So out of all of this, the future leadership of the LSSP actually managed to gain quite a high profile. They helped radicalise the movement and they seized the opportunity to create their own party, pulling in many participants from the Surya Mal and the youth leagues into the LSSP. The next key political test for the LSSP was the Second World War. And in Australia and in the West, the sort of dominant narrative about World War II is that it was a good war. It was a fine war, it was a just war, it was a war for democracy, it was a war against fascism. But actually in the colonial world, the true imperialist nature of this war was quite clear. This World War, just like the First World War, was about dividing and redividing the globe between the big capitalist powers. Workers, soldiers, and the poor of the colonial world were simply chess pieces to be shifted around the board and traded between the big players. So the Ceylonese actually discovered, like many other oppressed nationalities, that all of the fine language and declarations of freedom and democracy by the Allied forces didn't actually apply to them. Their colonial masters were just as brutal and anti-democratic during the war as before. So the whole experience of colonial domination actually steeled many in the colonial war against the sort of justifications and the whole ideology of the war. The Trotskyist section of the LSSP leadership actually agreed with the Ceylonese masses to the hostility to the war, and they articulated it very clearly. And one particularly good example comes from the American Trotskyist journal, The Socialist Appeal, which in early 1939 actually published a piece by one of the LSSP leaders, Selina Pereira, called An Interview with a Comrade, Ceylonese Masses Want No Part of the Boss's War, which is a pretty good start, in my opinion. And then she goes on. Ceylon's 6 million workers and peasants are absolutely opposed to giving any sort of support to England in the present imperialist war. The reason for this is simple. This war is not being fought for democracy. This war is fought for who shall have the privilege of standing on our necks and exploiting our people. Ceylon, one of the colonies of the British and French empires, is a bone over which the imperialist dogs are fighting. The people of the colonies will have nothing to do with either gang. And so I think that's a clearly fairly unambiguous and principled rejection of imperial wars, you know, if you're ever likely to come across one. But that kind of statement and others like it, which were printed and reprinted across the world, was significant, not just because of that kind of steadfastness in rejecting the war, but also because they marked a significant break with the Stalinist currents in the LSSP, who were sort of vacillating backwards and forwards, backing the war, not backing the war, according to the dictates of the USSR. And the Trotskyist section of the LSSP decided to use this opportunity as, a time to make a very clear and principled break with the Stalinists. And this came in December of 1939, when the LSSP Executive Committee, by 29-5, which is a very significant number, adopted a resolution that said the following. Since the Third International, which is the Stalinist international body, has not acted in the interests of the international revolutionary working class movement, while expressing its solidarity with the Soviet Union, the First Workers' State, the Lanka Sama Samaja Party declares that it has no faith in the Third International. And this was actually one of the most significant and explicit breaks towards Trotskyism in the history of the LSSP. So from 1940 onwards, the LSSP was clearly and professedly a Trotskyist organisation. And actually, this sharpening up of their position against the war and more clearly in support, of ending the war by revolutionary struggle across the world, that kind of position didn't actually lose them popular support, it gained them popular support. In reality, it actually helped them to relate to workers' grievances, because actually the Stalinists at this time in the union movement, in society more generally, were encouraging Ceylonese workers to stay at work, to continue to labour in support of the war effort all of the time, while their rights and, their living standards were being driven down further and further. And so out of all of this, the LSSP managed to gain something of a following amongst different sections of the working class. And in particular, it led several strikes, including hospital workers. They also helped lead a general strike in 1944. And all of this meant that they were actually beginning to be able to capture the leadership of the Government Workers' Union in Colombo, which was one of the most significant unions in that city. But the LSSP's steadfast opposition to the war did actually bring down the wrath of the local and colonial authorities on them. And two Sama Samajist members of the Parliament of the State Council, who'd been elected years before, were removed in mid-1940 for their opposition to World War II, and they were subsequently locked up, and along with the bulk of the rest of the leaders of the LSSP, they were basically shoved in prison. And there's some wonderful stories about how they managed to escape prison. Apparently, I just read this recently, they were in prison and they managed to escape a few times just to have some meetings outside of the prison. But on one particular occasion, they just decided not to go back. So, anywho, not entirely sure how that happened, except that they seemed to have a prison guard who was a member. So I guess that always helps. So they actually escaped Ceylon and went to India, where basically they continued on their political work with some of the Indian Trotskyist groups. So after some of their initial success amongst the urban youth and in the Syria Mal movement, the early leaders of the LSSP actually began to recognise the importance of winning more industrial workers to their ranks. And they put a huge amount of effort into intervening in the existing trade union movement and attempted time and time again to win workers to a much more radical class struggle perspective. And they had attempted all of this in the early 1930s with some limited sort of success in a number of different areas, but they actually hadn't made any major headway. But in 1937, and after the sort of more formal establishment of the Trotskyists, as a cohered party, they began to redouble their efforts. And this time they actually had more success. The Sama Samajists succeeded in organising a number of unions under their own control, particularly on the railroads and in manufacturing. But it was their efforts in organising amongst some of the estate or their plantation workers that actually threw that whole national spotlight on the LSSP and meant that they could gain a much more, a much larger following amongst workers. And key to this whole process was the so-called brace girdle incident in 1937. And I think it's just worth saying something about this because it gives some flavour of the situation. And there was a couple of great quotes which I just felt like I couldn't leave out. So Mark Anthony Lester Brace Girdle was a young Australian who actually went to work as a planter in one of the tea plantations, and he'd sort of been associated with the Communist Party in both Britain and in Australia, and you know, had moved over there basically to get a job in the Depression. But in a sort of very positive development, Brace Girdle actually found the sort of exploitation, you know, the devastating conditions of plantation workers, the local plantation workers, absolutely unbearable. And he began to side with workers in a strike, you know, which he really encouraged them to do. And fairly unsurprisingly, he was promptly sacked by the plantation owners. Brace Girdle left the plantations and went to Colombo. He joined the LSSP there, and fairly quickly after that, he was co-opted onto its executive committee. The LSSP thereupon encouraged Brace Girdle to tour the plantation areas and encourage rebellions and organisation. And it sort of mattered in some ways also that he was white. You know, this you know, was a real threat to the authorities. And, you know, this also sort of surprised a lot of the local planters who basically had a fairly plantation workers who were had a fairly sort of hostile attitude to lots of whites until this point. So it was, you know, really moving for a lot of people to see this white chap get up and encourage them in their rebellions. And these speaking tours were immensely successful. On the 3rd of April, the LSSP held a meeting in the middle of the plantation area, which some 2,000 estate workers attended. And really, when you've got to think, the country is not that big. It's also the levels of repression. You know, these people who are basically being driven into the ground, ground down day after day by their experiences at work, are prepared to defy it and to go to a meeting to listen to this guy speak. And the police and the local authorities were totally, totally freaked out. And this is from the police report. The most noteworthy feature of the meeting was the presence of Brace Girdle and his attack on the planters. He claimed unrivaled knowledge of the misdeeds of the planters and promised scandalous exposures. His delivery, facial appearance, his posture were all very threatening. Every sentence was punctuated with excited cries from the labourers, a bit like my talk today. labourers were heard to remark that Mr. Brace Girdle has correctly said that they should not allow planters, which are the sort of bosses, to break labour laws, and they must in future not take these things lying down. And that kind of situation, as I said before, was pretty unbearable to the colonial administration, who actually found the prospect of plantation workers organising under a revolutionary leadership very threatening indeed. They found lots of things very threatening. And I just wanted to read a statement from the governor, Reginald Stubbs, who stated, "Hitherto, no notice," I wish I could do it in a plummy sort of British accent, but I can't. Yes, please. "Hitherto no notice has been taken of the antics of the local Communist Party, who are generally regarded as half-wits or degenerates. I'm inclined to think that we have been far too lenient in this respect, and I am now considering what steps it's desirable to take in view of information I have received from many sources as to the spread of communist opinions amongst the lower classes. The organ of the Communist Party, the Summer Samaja, is becoming more and more scurrilous. For example," and this is their example, "in a recent number, Her Late Majesty Queen Victoria was referred to by a Sinhalese phrase meaning the woman Victoria." Out of all of the things they could have found the most scurrilous, really. But, you know, for these and fairly, you know, other misdemeanours, Brace Girdle was ordered by Stubbs to be deported. He went into hiding, but the LSSP was able to protect him until he made a surprise appearance, sort of jumping out, you know, not, I sort of imagine him jumping out of a box or something, but I think he just walked through the crowd and got up on the stage and spoke at one of the May Day demonstrations. And actually the authorities were powerless to do anything because this demonstration was attended by 50,000 people in support of him. So the LSSP had clearly done a really stellar job of combining what had begun as an economic struggle with a more political outrage at the fact that the colonial administration felt like they could just do whatever they wanted with, you know, the local people, deport them here, deport them there, whatever. And the level of outrage at the administration's plans and the presence of a number of LSSP members in Parliament actually managed to scuttle the deportation plans, and Brace Girdle was able to stay. So the event proved a really significant victory for the LSSP, and it helped establish them on the national stage as a national organisation with some real pulling power, an organisation which could get things done, defy the authorities, defy the planters, and actually, you know, win. So after World War II, the LSSP actually managed to continue to grow amongst the Ceylonese working class, and again, they gained control of a number of key unions. The union movement itself actually expanded massively over this time, and it grew to an estimated 300,000 workers across Sri Lanka, and again, it's a small country. So it's quite significant that those members and the unions of the time were mainly dominated and were mainly in Marxist unions and the Ceylon Workers' Congress, which was dominated by the LSSP. And all of this managed to, sort of build up to a number of general strikes in 1946 and in 1947. And then again, there was another major round of upheaval and social challenge in 1953 in the Hartal. So for those of you who don't know, a Hartal is something more than a general strike. It actually involves the voluntary closing of schools and places of business, in addition to workers staying away from their jobs. And the Hartal of August the 12th in 1953 was organised as a protest against the government's decision to end a weekly rice ration, which had been established during the Second World War and which was basically people's living, diet. And this Hartal actually involved an almost total general strike in two-thirds of the country and a near-insurrectionary level of activity in whole swathes of the countryside. And here, disruption of the transport system became absolutely key. In a number of places, the rails and the sleeper lines on the train lines were literally torn up and turned over kilometre after kilometre. Telegraph posts were toppled amongst the whole stretch, so communication systems were brought down. You know, when you think about the kind of organisation it requires to topple a telegraph post, I mean, this is some serious action. In other parts of the country, wooden sleepers were set on fire along the train tracks, basically destroying the track. And in probably hundreds of places in various areas, the signal wires were cut. And in other parts, people defied the authorities more and more. And in one particular place, in Igoda Uyana, the locals actually invaded the station. They captured a train which was taking police to try and crush, demonstrations in one other section of the country. They basically captured the train, uncoupled the engine so that the train could not leave. So, you know, all of these sorts of things are happening across the country at the same time as workers in the cities are on strike. And that all of that was not just rampant destruction. It was well organised, well thought through, it was militant action, and it was all designed to achieve a very particular end. And as you can imagine, with that level of social organisation, with that level of agitation amongst both the working classes and of the people in the countryside, the Hartal actually succeeded in its objective of preventing the elimination of the rice ration. But more than that, it actually demonstrated to the authorities and to the local capitalists that workers and people in the countryside were not prepared to put up with constant attacks on their living standards and were prepared to demand more in their own lives. So how did the LSSP fare in that whole uprising? Well, there are sort of debates, as anyone who's read the series of documents, which were sort of recommended if people read them, called Blows to the Empire. I think we've sold out, so bad luck. But there are a series of sort of debates in that book about the extent to which this was a genuinely insurrectionary moment in the history of Ceylon, about, you know, whether or not the LSSP should have pushed to take power, whether they shouldn't have, what the exact dynamic of the thing was. And, you know, it's pretty hard to say, you know, either which way. But what we can say about the LSSP was that, and it was almost universally accepted that, in the areas where the most determined fight was waged, where there was the most recognition of the strikes amongst workers, where the most workers stayed out, where there was the most organised and cohered resistance in the countryside, that those were the places where the LSSP totally dominated. So, you know, what we can say is that the LSSP, because of their politics, not in spite of it, was prepared to be the force that was the most organised, that was going to push forward, which was not going to capitulate with the authorities, and so forth. So, before I conclude, I just wanted to say a couple of things about the LSSP's attitude to the divisions in the Tamil and Sinhalese communities. In 1948, the British essentially granted home rule to Ceylon. And while there had been significant working class and peasant struggles to end colonial rule, this wasn't a sort of national and cohered movement in the same way as movements in other sorts of parts of the colonial world had been, cutting across all of the sort of communal divides that had existed. And that fact, as well as the kind of economic competition which was fostered between the two communities, and a whole sort of quite complex history of British and Portuguese and French playing the Sinhalese and Tamils off each other, all of this actually meant that independence saw the rise of a chauvinist, nationalist, Buddhist Sinhalese movement. And this movement found its expression in a cultural renaissance amongst the Sinhalese. In particular, this drive saw moves to enshrine Sinhalese as the only language of state, thereby excluding the significant Tamil majority from the whole political process and from working in a whole series of key government areas. And this chauvinism also developed over the years into a very brutal, violent hostility towards Tamils by significant sections of the Sinhalese majority. But the Lanka Sama Samaja Party was actually the only party with a base amongst the Sinhalese that stood firmly for a long period of time to its policy, which it initially developed, of having both Sinhala and Tamil as official languages. And it might not come as any surprise, but the Communist Party actually changed its position fairly quickly to, you know, in an opportunist way, to just sort of relate to the dominant sentiment of the time. And actually, it has to be said that the LSSP suffered really greatly by taking such a principled and anti-communal stand. In October in 1955, a public meeting held by the party on this question in Colombo, in the town hall there, it was actually attacked by a hostile crowd with brickbats and bombs, and the police stood by. But the police did finally move into action at one point, but it was only to baton charge and attack the LSSP members who were coming out of this meeting arguing against communal divides. The party also lost heavily amongst the Sinhalese base, and although it won the sympathy of wide sections of the minorities in Sri Lanka, that in no way compensated for their losses. So the party's position on the question of citizenship of workers of Indian origin, again, as I said before, many Indian workers were forcibly transported from the south of India, and the whole question of their rights in Sri Lanka and in Ceylon actually became a real one. And despite the fact that, you know, a lot of Sinhalese sentiment amongst their base was whipped up against these people, the party never ceased its opposition to the unjust citizenship laws and stuck to its position that all permanent residents should be granted citizenship. And Leslie Gunawardena says in his history, "As a revolutionary socialist party, the Lanka Sama Samaja Party could not have acted otherwise. For as distinct from opportunist politicians for whom power is an end in itself, for the LSSP, power is only a means to an end. That end is socialism. And it knows that socialism cannot be built except on the basis of the unity and willing cooperation of the masses of all of the communities that inhabit Ceylon. and that unity and cooperation can only be achieved by a correct attitude to the problem of minorities. So, to conclude, I guess for a relatively small Trotskyist organisation like Socialist Alternative, the fact that an organisation like the LSSP, albeit in very different circumstances and times, the fact that nonetheless a group like this could actually gain a mass following, that they could lead unions, that they could head major struggles against something as repressive as colonial rule, and also lead struggles against challenges to local capitalism, I think all of this offers a very inspiring example of the possibilities for revolutionary ideas to gel with the mass of a country's population. And indeed, I think it has to be said that the LSSP's popularity often came because of their Trotskyist politics rather than in spite of it. And so for those of us who are actually committed to building a genuine alternative to the kind of, Stalinist currents or the currents like the Labour Party that we see in Australia today, for those of us who are genuinely committed to building this kind of tradition, you know, where we can, in whatever way we can, I think that fact, the fact that these ideas could gel with a lot of people in society, and I still think that they can in somewhere like Australia today, all of that, I think, should really give us heart.